Dr. Stephen Leib has over 30 years of investment experience, former editor of Personal Finance, and had over 100,000 subscribers, author of several books. Welcome back, Dr. Leib.
Chris, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I return the compliments. You know, to me, it's a bit remarkable that the market is not really reacting that much to the threats from Korea and these horrible hurricanes, Harvey, which just devastated Houston and good part of Texas, I mean, you know, southern Texas. And now we have another hurricane that's approaching Florida. And I think the market's been really calm in the face of this, and I think that that's probably says a lot about, you know, the financial and economic underpinnings of the market right now. I think they're pretty good. Gold is very interesting at this point. And I think that my guess is that if I had to guess, and usually when you have to guess, you're usually wrong, but my guess is that gold could pull back a little bit here. But I think that we have very close to an all-in buy signal on gold. Longer term. Probably the most interesting news event surrounding any market was that surrounding gold in the past week or so. The Nikkei Asian Review, which I think is a very well-respected news source out of Asia, actually out of Japan, reported that China plans by the end of the year to launch a new oil benchmark, Eastern oil benchmark, and that's where the action is going to be in oil, because that's where the demand is going to come from in the East, and also the supply. I think they have about 75% of all the hydrocarbons in the world. They're going to trade this oil benchmark in yuan that's backed by gold. That could be a real game changer, Chris, for various reasons. Oil, despite the fact that it's, you know, trading, well, I guess Brent's a bit over 50, and I guess West Texas is around 50 right now, down, but it still is by far and away the most important commodity in the world. And as we know, one of the sources of the dollar's reserve currency status, a very critically important source, has been its role as a petrol currency. Oil's always been denominated in dollars, not always, but I guess, you know, at least for the last 40 plus years. This threatens to change that with all sorts of implications, because, you know, a currency backed by gold is going to be very, very attractive to Middle Easterners. I mean, they like gold and they respect gold, and gold has a lot longer history than the dollar. And the yuan is basically, you know, assuming a much more prominent role. I mean, the Silk Road countries that China's trying to unite around, you know, infrastructure and trade, hard and soft economic policies and political policies, is an amazing center for growth. And probably will be where a lot of the growth in the world takes place over the next generation. And right now, China is the by far and away the major player in that part of the world. There's a good chance that this new trading vehicle, this new benchmark that denominated in yuan and gold, will spread to other trading, at least within the Eastern sphere. And that could mean that the dollar loses a lot of its reserve currency cachet. I mean, it may not happen overnight, but it just seems to me that it's the way the world is going at this point. China, by far and away, is the world's leading trader, and they're the leading trader in that part of the world which has the greatest growth, and it could be a very, very significant game changer on many, many levels. I think it speaks to much higher commodity prices almost across the board. It speaks to a much lesser role for the dollar. This doesn't mean doomsday for the United States, by no means, but it could mean, you know, more inflation, and it could mean that we, you know, we have to adjust to some extent. The implications are very, very broad-based. It hasn't come to pass yet, but I really do suspect it will. And I have to say, I did say so about a year ago. This was my expectation. It just seemed like China is very uncomfortable with the dollar, and they were looking for a way out. This is the most logical way out. Take the most important commodity, start trading it with the yuan and gold as a backing. That takes you step one. I don't believe that the Chinese want to see the yuan as a reserve currency. I mean, there are responsibilities that go with that. My guess is, and again, I want to underline and boldface guess here, is that we may see some sort of cryptocurrency in which gold is a part. You can create blockchains in which other things are part of that chain rather than just currencies. You can create cryptocurrencies which include gold. I mean, you can create a blockchain that will accommodate those kinds of cryptocurrencies. And I have a feeling we'll see something like that used for trade within the Eastern sphere, probably within the next year or so. What that means for Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, I'm not sure. They could still exist alongside of it. This might be a country-to-country kind of blockchain for doing major trade, or it could be something more than that. I don't think any big guesswork at this point, but the fact is, the world is changing. I do see that this could be a game changer, what China plans to do with oil.
And China, you may have read recently, just created its own institute for cryptocurrency. So this is a government-sponsored, I don't consider either of us elitists, but it does require a PhD just to be invited to this institute where they're attempting to find ways to back the yuan with a blockchain-like structure. And I think that just supports your whole thesis. They are concerned by the soundness of our reserve currency and are interested in an alternative.
I think you raise a very good point about the Chinese institutes, etc. The Chinese tend to do everything methodically and with a very long-term perspective. I don't understand the intricacies of blockchain, etc. They are very, very complicated. And you do need probably a PhD in computer science to really understand the ins and outs. But what little I do know is that it requires tremendous computational, not only skills, but also the physical computational machines, massive computer facilities in order to do it. I think I've read reports that they're up to in terms of Bitcoin doing quintillions of calculations per second to keep track of all the transactions that take place and the mining of additional Bitcoin. So, you're absolutely right that this is not a simple task. In order to include gold as part of the blockchain, which is what I think they do plan. In fact, I'm quite sure they plan. There are so many reports out of China. Just look at the color of their flag. It's gold stars on top of red. Gold is part of their culture. It's part of their DNA, if you will. And there are quotes from the secretary in charge of gold, that were written in Chinese, not necessarily for American consumption. They say just straight out that gold is a key to the Chinese dream. And gold is a very, very special metal in that it's both a commodity and a currency. So they do regard it as a currency, not just another financial asset, but as a currency. It would be a very interesting, it would make a lot of sense if you are interested in gold and you do believe in the merits of blockchain. And I think there are a lot of merits to blockchains. I think they are secure. They could be made more secure, hence the Chinese investment, et cetera. There's a lot of good reasons for doing it. And I guess what I wanted to end up saying is the Chinese have been really prepared for this. By a large margin, they are the world's biggest producer of hydropower. And hydropower is very interesting because it's basically free. Once the dams are built, et cetera, it's free. Electricity. And electricity is a limiting factor in doing all these computer calculations. They're energy intensive and you need free sources of electricity. And though if you look at just Bitcoin itself, right now the distribution of the trading in Bitcoin is basically, I think it's spread pretty evenly among the major economies of the world. It used to be China did about 80% of the trading in Bitcoin, but now, we're up there. We do a lot of trading in this country too. But where China has a near monopoly is in the mining of Bitcoin. And they do about 80% of the mining. And again, that's because they have the world's largest supercomputers. And one reason they have the largest supercomputers is that they have the largest source of free energy in the world. This is a way in which they make use of this. Now, whether, when they were thinking about this 10 years ago, I don't know. But it would not surprise me if they were. They have a very natural edge in all things cryptocurrency because they just have the computing power. They have a fantastic amount, and literally, I use that word advisedly, almost fantasy-like computing power over there. And that gives them the ability to dominate a lot of these cryptocurrencies or whatever is going to happen in the cryptocurrency world by buying stocks like Microsoft, Intel, NVIDIA, Applied Materials. There's a bunch of companies that will benefit from this. It's hard for me to see which of the cryptocurrencies will, though I would have said the same thing admittedly 6 months ago, and look what's happened to Bitcoin.
Almost 8 years ago, I started mining Bitcoin just as a lark. I thought it was an interesting project. But you're right. Since then, I'm sure you've heard of the halving. What happens is the difficulty increases almost exponentially. It's not so much the computing power at this point, because although you're absolutely right on the energy consumption, that's the biggest constraint. Right now, we have S3, S7, and S9 miners that you can purchase for, a couple thousand online, or about a kilowatt of power each unit per hour. And as you say, they have such inexpensive energy in China, and that has just facilitated everyday folks, not just the government, but small business people, to capitalize on Bitcoin. And even when Bitcoin was low, they were thinking about the future, so they've accumulated huge resources of the cryptocurrency. I feel that Russia and China, they've really picked up the ball here, whereas we're behind the curve and even fighting it. I feel that our policymakers are fighting cryptocurrencies instead of recognizing there is an opportunity to benefit as a society from the trend. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I mean, there's certainly nothing happening on the governmental level as far as cryptocurrencies go, as far as our computer industry goes. I mean, everything is being done by private enterprise, which is great. I mean, I'm all for private enterprise. I'm all for our way of government. But I think that on certain major projects, the Apollo project, I mean, sending man to the moon, building an interstate highway, building out a cryptocurrency, blockchains, etc., there's nothing wrong with private and government cooperation. And I think that's sort of what China does. And they do try and assemble a collection of the best of the best, you know, in terms of kids and young computer programmers under the auspices of the government, and I guess to some extent companies like Baidu. But Baidu is working with the government in China. I mean, companies like Google are not really being in any way subsidized or helped by the government in terms of developing these kinds of projects. And it, you know, China just is out front on this, and I think we've got to wake up. I agree with you. If we want to maintain a real viable role, I mean, the last I heard was an article I think dated in June or July, I mean, very recent article, the amount of mining that we do of Bitcoin in this country is about 1%, which is ridiculous. China's doing 80 or 85% to our 1%, though we are trading it. But we're trading those Bitcoins that come out of China. And as you pointed out, as we get toward, you know, the limit on how many Bitcoins you can mine, and it's by design. It's one thing that makes Bitcoin, I think, very attractive and probably more attractive than the Ether, associated with the other major blockchain, Ethereum, is that Bitcoin is by design limited to 21 million. As you get toward that limit, it becomes, like you pointed out, it becomes extraordinarily energy intensive, computer intensive to do the mining. And as the number of transactions increase, it becomes extremely intensive to do those transactions, computer intensive. And we're not, I mean, I think we're asleep at the switch, Chris. To be very honest, I think that's what you're saying, and I think that there's a lot of room for improvement.
What I find is maybe the big missed opportunity here for the Pentagon. This not only, I think, represents a threat to dollar hegemony, but it also, it's interesting because, you know, we always talk about the Chinese word for, you remember, opportunity is also that of danger, loosely there. Well, we see the same situation, I think, with the blockchain revolution that's underway, because the Pentagon has an opportunity here, and maybe you could say the current administration and Congress, but to pick up the ball here, because the blockchain revolution is going to rival the Forex. We think this is going to become a $5 to $10 trillion market. We think this will actually eclipse the Forex, so the Bitcoin being about 30% of that market. So I see Bitcoin at about a $3 to $4 trillion market in the next 10 years. What that means is the U.S. dollar, of course, will shrivel to just almost third world status. And so the Pentagon really needs to get ahead of this, on, I think, the forefront of this, and establish for the military as well as for the federal government, because I believe our policymakers, they're sticking their collectively their heads in the sand, because they recognize millions of wasteful jobs will evaporate separate from the blockchain revolution, which eliminates all of that wasted time and useless paper pushing. And that's what blockchain does. And I think they're concerned about that, but instead they have to embrace it.
I tend to agree with you. I mean, regardless whether or not blockchain is part of a new reserve currency, which I think there's a good chance it will be with the Chinese, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's something that should be totally embraced for no other reason than it's, if done correctly, it's extremely secure, much more secure than the way we're doing things now. I mean, and again, who proves the point? The Chinese. I mean, look what they've stolen from us. I mean, they've stolen all our technologies. I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's terrible. But they have done that, and they've done it through hacking into our systems. I mean, they know more about people with clearance in this country than people themselves know. I mean, they have, you know, the biographies of all our leading spies at this point, because they've been able to hack into our systems. I mean, blockchain is, if anything, if nothing else, is a way of protecting against this kind of a hacking. And also, Chris, to second what you're saying, one of the companies that is extremely interested in using this right now and is certainly active in a lot of trading is NASDAQ. It's a public company. And it's one that I'm looking at very, very carefully. They may be using blockchain in the not too distant future, trading stocks, and that could give them a big leg up. But again, it's the fact that these companies have to go it alone. I mean, there's really no government support for it. And you're right, figuratively speaking, it's a crime that the Pentagon is not deeply involved in this technology at this point, deeply involved. So I could not agree with you more.
It's one of these big question marks, and I like the fact that you brought up the hacking. The reality is, if you look at the lack of security measures, especially at our local utility level and things of that nature, I mean, we really are just so behind the curve here. And I'm glad that there's folks like you who are sort of sounding the alarm, as with your book with Red Alert and others.
I've been talking about it for a couple of years, but I think now is the time. More or less convinced that, you know, you are going to see really exciting things in the gold and precious metal markets.
The technicals seem to support your view there. It looks like we are, you know, all the stars are aligned here for some solid breakout to continue finally. I mean, we could also look at the United States. I think we forget how long we had silver currency in circulation. I'm sure you remember you had silver dimes, silver quarters.
Now I think about it, I remember, you know, silver being, you know, a word on the dime, and I think the quarter too. I mean, save those and some really rare baseball cards.
Eventually, you're right. A major, I think, country will definitely see the opportunity to link their currency, and it probably, as you said earlier, will be China. They're fed up, as you said, with the U.S. dollar.
Where I really hate to say it, and this is really chilling in a way. I mean, if the dollar loses a lot of its reserve currency status, especially in the East, then we lose the ability to impose sanctions on countries like North Korea. And I think that that is part of what's going on here. I mean, we're not going to be able to sanction North Korea unless we have the financial infrastructure to make those sanctions, really have bite. And if we don't have the reserve currency, you know, that infrastructure goes by the wayside. And that worries the heck out of me. It really does. China right now is, you know, they're on top of their game. And, you know, I think we've got to play catch up, but I think we can. And I just think that we have to recognize, you know, what's going on here. Whatever you think of him, and, you know, I had certainly a lot of qualms about him, but I think someone like Steve Bannon was aware of all this. He's gone. And I had a lot of problems with Steve Bannon. I mean, you know, I really did. But I think he was still, you know, in terms of China, he saw us at economic war with China. And I think that really has to be the way we view this at this point. I mean, you know, we don't want to get into any kind of physical wars, but an economic war. But we want a side where we still have, you know, control of our destiny. And I think we can do that. But it's going to take, I think, a change of perspective, if you will. I think that's sort of what you're saying. I think that we've dropped the ball. I mean, I think it's called, you know, wide-eyed complacency. And something's got to wake us up. I think that maybe when we see this benchmark being traded in yuan and gold, that may be the wake-up call. And maybe that'll really get us going. So, you know, yes, I think this is a great country. I think we're going through a very, very tough time now. And I think that, you know, there are two roads out. One, you know, being positive, in which we maintain control of our destiny, and one being, you know, much more negative, in which the Chinese have more control than probably they even want. I don't think the Chinese want hegemony over the whole world. I mean, that's not part of their culture. And why we should accept it. You know, we can maintain a lot of control of our own destiny.
If you really look at the country as a whole, they decided, look, we don't want too much interaction with other cultures. It always ends badly, it seems, for us. Let's try to maintain the status quo. This has been, I think, their modus operandi for at least 2,000 or 3,000 years. You know, the Opium Wars, their Tea Party, if you will. They toss the crates into the Gulf there. When I think of China, I don't think of an imperial, destructive...
Totally agree, Chris. There's no... I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's no evidence of it. It's almost... If we don't do something, we're almost forcing them into a position where they're going to, you know, assume hegemony. Not because they want to, but because the world will be chaotic if they don't. And there's no reason for that to happen. I mean, it would be really just a sin. And I don't think it will happen, because I don't think China wants it to happen. I mean, you know, China's interested in China, interested in win-win situations as much as anything else. A win-lose situation creates problems down the road from their perspective. But a win-win situation, they're fine. They're happy. Their ethos is not that they are the best, but that they are self-fulfilled as a people. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're better or worse materially or anything else. It just means that, you know, what's good for China is good. It doesn't mean that what's bad for America is good for China. No, not at all. If it can be what's good for America is also good for China. So, yeah, I'm just saying in more words than I need to. I agree.
Exactly. And before we move on to the last topic here, precious metals, I'd just like to wrap it up. Much of China, at least the older China as we knew it, is still Taoist. I mean, they have those Taoist roots. And of course, I think this is about harmony. It's about unity.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because Xi Jinping, paramount leader of China, I mean, is not, I think, necessarily doing what he's doing. I think he's doing what he's doing because he thinks this is necessary for China right now to root out the corruption. But he's also been friendly toward Taoism, toward Buddhism, toward religion in general. He's not, you know, I don't know what his own personal views are. I don't know whether he's an atheist or agnostic or really a Buddhist or a Taoist. I don't know. But I do know that, you know, in his previous postings, he's been very friendly toward the religions. I mean, he thinks it's part of China's culture, and it is. You know, it's been around for thousands of years. You know, Confucianism, well, that's sort of a social religion. But, you know, also the other religions, he's not against it. Goes along with what, you know, you're saying. I mean, the leaders right now are sort of basically supporting, you know, are certainly not against religion, providing it's not a direct threat to the state.
Can you give us an idea of just what might cause this breakout that we've seen in the yellow metal and silver in recent weeks, you know, might take us back to our former 2011 peak?
I think we're going to go well past those peaks, Chris, to be very honest with you. And I don't think it'll take a whole lot. Once gold is seen as backing a critical trade in the East, and that would be trade in oil, trade in other commodities, I think you'll see gold just fly. I mean, the value of gold right now, all the gold in the world is, I don't know, something a little bit less than $8 trillion. I don't know how much of that is available as either bars or investment, and it might be less than half. So you're talking $3-4 trillion backing up many, many times that amount of trade that takes place. And, you know, that suggests that gold could go up, I think, many fold from here. I mean, you know, I'm not saying tomorrow, but I do think that it's no longer a buy the dip, sell the rally kind of market. I think it's don't sell the rally, buy the dip. I think gold can go much higher than people think at this point. And I do think that the catalyst will be when China does start backing a currency, whether it be a cryptocurrency or whether it be just the yuan. At first, it'll be just the yuan, and I think that will gravitate into a cryptocurrency in which gold is a component. Gold's going to have to go up a lot in order to justify its role as backing trade, let's say, within the, if it's just the Eastern Hemisphere, would still be massive amounts of trade and growing trade, trade that grows much, much faster than the supply of gold could ever grow. I mean, you know, we're basically at peak gold right now. I mean, I don't know whether we can even mine much more gold. I mean, I know China's been mining almost surely at a loss. I mean, they're the number one gold producer in the world. And their reserves are, they're not anywhere near number one. I think they've been mining, you know, 10 to 20% of their reserves every year. And the only way you can do that and add to reserves is mining at a big, big loss. So there's obviously a reason they've been doing this. And again, I think you'll see the reason very quickly with this, you know, new oil contract benchmark with gold as a backing. And I think that will be a massive catalyst.
You know, you've mentioned in the past that China could have as much as 30,000 tons of reserves.
What I think is probably, yes. I mean, I don't know if they have 30,000, but I would say that the numbers that I've seen that I'm pretty comfortable with, 20,000 tons. But the Silk Road itself, you know, the other countries along the Silk Road in total could have as much as 35,000 or 30, somewhere close to 35,000 tons of gold. And that's what really counts. And that would, you know, dwarf the amount of gold held by all the other countries outside the Silk Road. I mean, you know, some people even question the 8,000 tons that we supposedly have. But even if we do have it, and Germany has, I don't know, whatever it is, 3,000 tons, et cetera, if you add up all that, it's not going to come, it's going to come to probably less than half what's available in the East. So, yeah, they do have the resources, the gold resources, the East, in order to affect this. And China, you know, with 20,000 tons would be by far the leader. So, you know, this is not pie-in-the-sky stuff. It is speculation, as you say, but I think it's speculation with a lot of reason. We still seem to be misdirected, I think, you know, toward maintaining our leadership and our independence in this world is probably technology and doing what we've always done, created these technologies. I think this country lost so much when we lost Bell Labs, when we turned Bell Labs over to Lucent. I'm not even sure Lucent still exists, and I'm sure Bell Labs is a shadow of itself. You know, that was good. I mean, there was nothing wrong with AT&T sort of being a controlled monopoly, kind of a private-public company. I mean, in the sense, I mean, there were things wrong with that, but there were also things very good. And Bell Labs was, you know, that's where the transistor came from, where the laser came from. That's where the internet came from.
Yeah, Dr. Shockley and his team, the disruptive eight, are the ones that broke away from Shockley, who had just earned the Nobel Prize for his transistor that you referred to, all formed the Fairchild Semiconductor, which then went on, helped put us on the moon.
Massive resources in order to bring this stuff to fruition. Who was going to sponsor Shockley at all if not for the government and the private sector together? I mean, you know, the private sector, you know, doesn't have the luxury of spending right now, you know, tremendous amounts of money on something that'll pay off in 10 or 15 years. I don't think the Chinese private sector would do that either. They don't, even though long-term thinking is part of the Chinese culture, etc. It used to be part of our culture too, Chris. I mean, when I was a kid, I was always taught that, you know, you should save money and defer gratification. I mean, you know, not as a religious principle, but as an economic principle. I mean, you know, that's how you build up investment capital. And we've lost that. I mean, we really have. It would come back with a government that tends to be a little bit more forward-looking than the government's than governments of recent years have been. I'm not making a Democratic or Republican comment here. I'm not saying which is best, but I'm just saying that, you know, governments that look ahead are governments that are going to, you know, secure the future of their countries. We have to do that here more. We have to sort of take a lesson from our own past and also from what China is doing in our present. And if we can do that, I think we can, you know, create or be part of a new world. And it could be very exciting, or it could be very, very stressful, you know, depending on which fork in the road we take.
We certainly like to get folks over to The Complete Investor.
You can always drop me a line if you want to comment, or drop you a line, and I'll be happy to comment on anything, you know, whatever.
Exactly. And, you know, we're still looking forward to your magnum opus on the yellow metal.
Right. Well, we do have the proposal's complete, and it's, I would say, you know, more than half the book. So, you know, it could happen. Chris, I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have the best day.
You too. Chris, it's always a pleasure.
With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. GoldSeek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%. totaling 6.5 million ounces. Mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.